Well, good afternoon. I have a laptop here to set up because I've got a few slides. Hopefully add some interest this afternoon. Been a long time since I've seen some of your faces. Others of you have been in the Twin Cities lately and I've seen you, but it's been a while. Thank Mr. Hansen for giving us a sermonette about what we're doing here so far in our music. And I also have to blame Mr. Hansen for the fact that I'm here today. Or you can blame Mr. Hansen for the fact that I'm here today. This was supposed to be Mr. Marker's Sabbath, but he is in Switzerland, and we're going to play a DVD here. Steve thought it'd be more fun if we had a live speaker, so here I am, like it or not. But it's good to be here. And it's an auspicious occasion. Kathy was just explaining that this is your first potluck since the pandemic began, is it not? So, boy. And visitors, probably more people here today than there are in St. Paul. Could be. So, thank you for sort of inviting me on this auspicious occasion. On the topic of today, you've probably read the New Testament many times, undoubtedly, but I wonder if you can set each book of the New Testament in order of its composition, the date of its composition. When I open this up, I think I'll have the image that I need. You can view the New Testament in its natural order, the way that it's ordered in your Bible, the ministry of Christ, of course, then the letters of Paul and his travels, and the letters of the general epistles. That's the natural order of the New Testament. But the order of its composition is a little different, and it reveals something else. And that is because the New Testament was written largely, or partly at least, very largely, in opposition to opposition against the truth. That is, there was opposition against the truth, and the New Testament was written largely as opposition to that opposition. There were misunderstandings, there were outright distortions of the truth. They were being taught in the church in those days. And the timeline of the composition of the New Testament helps us to follow that thread, that battle that was going on against wrong doctrines. So that's the thread that I want to follow today. So I titled this, if you want a title, A Thread Through the 27. A Thread Through the 27, because I want to follow the thread of the problems that triggered the writing of all 27 books of the New Testament. Most of the books of the New Testament dealt directly, or at least partially, with that opposition. So I'm going to cover, unfortunately, a lot of dates today. The outline is very simple, but it's very long because you know right offhand that there are 27 books. And if I'm going to cover 27 of them, I'm going to have to go pretty fast. But along the way, I'd like to point out not only when it was written and where it was written, but why it was written. There are some important notes about why each one of them was written. And I think in doing so, you know, why would we want to do that? Because it's a foundation for understanding some of the more difficult things that are said in the New Testament. There are difficult scriptures. Some of the things that Peter said are hard to understand, unless we know what the writer was dealing with. And when he wrote that letter and why he wrote it is part of the reason why, big reason why he wrote that letter. Now, nobody knows for sure the exact dates of the composition of each of the 27 letters of the New Testament. I don't, certainly, but I'm going to give you my best guesses from what I've read, what I've found. So we will start with the year 31. Just because it all kind of starts there, doesn't it? The preaching of the gospel after Christ's ministry. 31 is everybody's best guess, or at least within the church, everybody's best guess of when the crucifixion was and when the New Testament was The gospel of the New Testament was subsequently spread to all the empire, began at that first Pentecost. I'm going to put up a map of who was there at that first Pentecost, hence the laptop. That's not working. This will probably work. There we go. And the scripture reference is Acts 2, verses 9 through 11, where it lists where all those Jewish people came from for that first Pentecost in 31. From the east, over here in the Parthian Empire, the Parthians, Medes, Media, Elamites, Mesopotamia, and Arabia. Judea, of course, is where they came to. And it says then from the north, they came from the Anatolian Peninsula. That is, it says, it lists Cappadocia, Pontus, Asia, Phrygia, Pamphylia, Crete, island down here, and strangers from Rome, and to the south, Egypt, and Libya, parts near Cyrene, it says in the New Testament, in Acts. And this would then account for how the New Testament church got spread far and wide. To Jews, however, we're just talking about spreading the gospel to Jews within the Parthian and the Roman empires. So then I will advance to the year 36. Year 36 is approximately when we first meet Saul at Stephen's stoning. And around 36 is also the time when we have the account of Simon the sorcerer, Simon Magus. He's an example, I think, and it's an important example of the diversity that there was among Jews and Samaritans in that time. A lot of ideas crept into the church, and we'll see later that those ideas had Jewish origins, that is, the people who propounded them were Jewish, but they weren't Jews who practiced Judaism. They had quite different ideas. There was a syncretism, in other words, or a mixing of Jewish thought and the Hellenistic ideas of the time. I mean, the Hellenistic, the philosophy and the learning of the Greeks was very influential, was very highly regarded, admired. And there were certain Jews who were trying to reconcile the philosophy of the Greeks and the learning of the Greeks with the Old Testament, to reconcile them with the scriptures. And they came up with some odd twistings of the Old Testament. So anyway, that's a significant year, I think. 36 is when Simon Magus was an example of that twisting. Year 37 was Acts 9, and this is approximate. This is Paul's conversion on the road to Damascus. Right. So Paul is moving from going out from Jerusalem to Damascus. He's converted somewhere along that road. Then he continues on to Damascus, and he goes back to Jerusalem. And he was there for a short time, and then he was sent home. Paul was sent home from Jerusalem all the way up here to Tarsus, his hometown. Several years, maybe seven. You know, this is 36, but maybe 7 years Paul was in Tarsus. Next significant date, and I haven't come to the New Testament yet, right? Except for the story in the book of Acts. We don't have the composition of any of the books yet. In Acts 10 and 11, we have the conversion of Cornelius. That would be about 41. Now we're 10 years after Pentecost. And we have visions by Peter, and we have the obvious giving of the Spirit to Cornelius so that they could tell that the Gentiles were indeed given God's Spirit without being circumcised. It was a big deal in 41 AD. There was a big controversy in the Jerusalem church. But here we were converting Gentiles, and they finally agreed, and they did not have to be circumcised. Okay, then let's jump to the year 44. Year 44, kind of small, but I've drawn a few lines here from Jerusalem spreading out to the island of Crete and to Cyprus and to Antioch up here in Syria. That's in Acts 11. And at that time, that's when Paul and Barnabas went to Antioch. They were ministering in Antioch at that time. Okay, that's 44. Now, the year 45, book one, if you're outlining which books. Book one, year 45, is James. I dated at 45 AD, the very first book of the New Testament. Some think it was written later, like 60 AD, near the end of James's life. But I agree with evidence that dates it in the 40s AD. And that would make it the first book written in the New Testament. It's instructive, I think, to note how long that was from Christ's death until they began to write the New Testament. Even if James is written that early, but he's still only the first book, think how long it was before they even started to compose the New Testament. They didn't see any need for a New Testament. They preached the gospel out of the Old Testament. You know, the Old Testament wasn't done away. It was changed. But they preached the gospel from the Old Testament up to this point. Now, why place James in the 40s? I would guess 44 because of Acts 11. For lack of real estate, I'll just read you from my notes here. Acts 11, verse 28 through 30. There stood up in Antioch, where Paul and Barnabas were, one of them named Agabus, and signified by the Spirit that there should be a great dearth throughout all the world, which came to pass in the days of Claudius Caesar. So Claudius Caesar was 41 through 54. So this is likely in the 40s. And it says in verse 29 that the disciples, every man according to his ability, determined to send relief unto their brethren which dwelt in Judea. They were up in Tarsus. Which also they did, and sent it to the elders by the hands of Barnabas and Saul. So this was about 44 before Paul's first journey. And the church at Antioch was sending relief to Judea because Judea was hard hit by the drought. So I think the book of James fits well with the 40s because of what James deals with. James is addressed to Christians around the empire, Jewish Christians at this point, who were generally richer than the church in Judea. And they were told to share. They were told to show kindness and to demonstrate their faith by their kindness. There were no Gentile churches yet in the 40s. And James does refer to the churches as synagogues, meeting in the synagogues, because at this point they were still all Jews, except Cornelius, as far as I know. And also, I note the thread that I'm trying to follow today is the thread of the opposition against the apostles. the heresies that they were fighting against in the New Testament. In the book of James, you see none of that. It doesn't happen yet in the book of James because it doesn't exist yet. It doesn't occur until the 50s. Another question would be then, how did the book of James get into the New Testament canon? Since all the other letters were written to Paul's church as well, because James was written to Christians who were in Anatolia. That letter was still there when the New Testament was canonized, probably. Canonized with the letters of Paul. Okay, 45 through 48, in chronology here, was Paul and Barnabas' first trip. I'll flip to a map of that. Never used this map. That was James going out in various directions to people throughout the empire, Jewish Christians throughout the empire. But Paul's first journey is this little squiggle over here from Antioch to Cyprus up into Galatia and the four churches at Antioch of Syria, Iconium, Derbe, and Lystra. These are all in the Roman province of Galatia. So they are the churches of Galatia. But Paul wrote no letters on his first journey, so we still only have one. That's about 26 to go. Next important event is not the writing of a letter either. Let's skip to 49 AD. 49 AD. In this map, I have a light line going from Jerusalem up to Antioch because it says in Acts 15, verse 1, certain men which came down from Judea taught the brethren and said, except you be circumcised after the manner of Moses, you cannot be saved. This incident is a key incident in the understanding of the New Testament, 49 AD. These certain men trigger the New Testament, the Jerusalem conference. And there's several observations I'd like to make about that Jerusalem conference and these certain men. James himself says that these men did not come from him. They did not come from James. He concludes in Acts 15, verse 24, for as much as we have heard that certain which went out from us, have troubled you with words, subverting your souls, saying, you must be circumcised and keep the law, it says, to whom we gave no such commandment. Right? Point one, then, under 49 AD, James didn't send them. Point 1A is it does not say in the original text, and keep the law. The issue was circumcision. The issue was circumcision. It was their idea, and it wasn't James's. Later on, by the way, in the book of Galatians, Paul also writes about people like that. And he says that before certain came from James, Peter ate with the Gentiles, and then he separated from them. But I don't think he means that James sent them. He came from the presence. They came from Judea. They came from the presence of James. But James, obviously, from the conclusion of the Acts 15 conference, did not send them. I suspect there's a recalling of this event in 1 John. 1 John 2, verse 19 says, they went out from us, but they were not of us. Now, this was written a long time later, about in the 90s, maybe AD. So it's a long time later, but I think he's recalling the same event. That these people that he's still fighting in the 90s AD came out from us, but they were not of us. Okay, that was point one. They didn't come from James. Number two, the issue of circumcision had already been decided. They came to Antioch preaching circumcision, but as we just covered back in 41, the issue had already been decided. They did not agree. Number three, this circumcision was not the circumcision of Judaism. It was not circumcision of Judaism. quote you something out of the book of Galatians, where Paul is fighting the same issue. In Galatians 5, verse 3, he says, "I testify again to every man that is circumcised that he is a debtor to do the whole law." Well, duh. I mean, if you're a Jew, of course that means you're going to keep the whole law. But these were Jews, but they were not practicing Judaism. They had no intention of obeying the whole law. This was circumcision for a different reason. It was a ritual work of law. It was being interpreted metaphorically. They were cutting away ties to the flesh, not coveting with God to obey. It's usually assumed. I think everyone assumes that if the issue is circumcision, the opposition must be Jews. Not necessarily. The opposition also preached circumcision, but they had no intention of keeping the law. And number four, under this year, these men did not go to Jerusalem. Ever notice that? In Acts 15, where the certain men came to Antioch, Paul and Barnabas went to get an answer because the congregation wanted an answer. The guys who brought the issue, they didn't go. There's no hint that they went. Why didn't they go? I think because they already knew what the answer would be. They had already argued the question with the apostles in Jerusalem, and they didn't respect the apostles in Jerusalem. They went elsewhere. So my diagram here, my map, has a line coming out of Antioch to question mark. Where did they go? You know, Paul and Barnabas went to Jerusalem to get the question settled once and for all. Where did the certain men go? We don't know. But it seems like we run across them later because they bring the issue other places. Okay, that was 49. Let's jump to the year 53. 50 through 53 is Paul's second journey. This is Paul's second journey, starting in Antioch, revisiting the four churches of Galatia, cutting across country, not going to Asia, but going to the straits up here, the Dardanelles, crossing over into Greece for the first time, into Europe, making churches in Philippi, in Thessalonica, and in Berea. His famous encounter with the philosophers in Athens, and then finally he reaches Corinth. The year 51, we come to book number two then. Book number two is 1 Thessalonians. From Corinth, Paul composes a letter and sends it to Thessalonica. And from Corinth, also he composes number three, which is 2 Thessalonians. Is there opposition in Thessalonica? Not much. I mean, there are hints. He does write in to the Thessalonians that there is a mystery of iniquity, he says, already at work. It's not Judaism, is it? It's iniquity. It's antinomianism. Anyway, at Corinth, he spends about a year and a half. Read this in Acts 18. He spends about a year and a half in Corinth. And then he returns. I'm not showing the return on this map, but he returns then to Antioch to end his second journey. Moving onward in time, 54 through 58. This is the third journey. He again leaves Antioch. He revisits the four churches of Galatia, but this time he heads straight overland to Ephesus for the first significant time in Ephesus. He spends 2 years working in Ephesus. And from Ephesus, we have book number four. The green line coming out of Ephesus to Corinth is 1 Corinthians. That would be about 57 AD. he writes to Corinth. In Ephesus, he has obviously heard of false teachers and divisions. We know there were great divisions in Corinth, and he writes 1 Corinthians. And then he travels to Corinth, but somewhere in Macedonia, he writes 2 Corinthians. And there was a very definite opposition, as you know, in Corinth, in the Corinthian church. They claim to be more spiritual than Paul. They claim that Paul is not a spiritual apostle. They see visions. They speak in tongues. You know, the issue of tongues comes up in Corinthians. In 2 Corinthians, Paul refers to them as the super apostles, or the superlative apostles, who claim to be superlative apostles. He spends 3 months here in Corinth. And in Corinth, at that time, he apparently hears of the trouble from the opposition in Galatia. And he writes Galatians from there. So the next map shows a green line coming from Corinth to the four churches in Galatia. That would be about 57. There are all kinds of ideas, by the way, about when Galatians was written. But I'll say this, the contents of Galatians is tightly connected to the contents of Romans. They are very similar, except one is more extensive than the other. And Romans, we're going to see, is associated with the church in Ephesus. I'll get to that in a moment. But it is. Romans is associated with the church in Ephesus. And the church in Ephesus hadn't been established until his third journey. So Galatians is written during his third journey. The opponents over in Galatia are causing trouble because they are preaching another gospel. They are Jews, but they are not practicing Judaism. They are Jews, and they are not a party of James, because James didn't send them. They argue in Galatia that Paul is a lesser apostle. He's just a physical apostle. All he knows is what he's learned from the apostles in Jerusalem, which are men. They, on the other hand, have had visions and dreams and met the real Christ themselves personally. Paul has to argue to the Galatians that he has also met the risen Christ, and that he is in turn, he has not spent much time in Jerusalem. He did not get his gospel from Jerusalem. He got his gospel from Jesus Christ. He does not bring up the Jerusalem conference. Well, this is 57 AD. He's arguing against circumcision. Now, why doesn't he say, and we went to Jerusalem and settled the issue, circumcision is no longer required? He doesn't bring it up in Galatians because it holds no water with them. The opposition would just use it as ammunition to say, look, all he does is echo what the apostles in Jerusalem say. So Paul doesn't bring it up. His opponents have no respect for the apostles in Jerusalem. Okay, at the same time, or shortly thereafter, from still in Corinth during those 3 months, green line this time goes to Rome, the book of Romans, late 57, maybe 58. In Romans, he doesn't argue so much against an opposition, but he takes a broader view. He argues that the God of the Old Testament is a faithful God, that he has not failed Israel, because the opposition has the idea that the God of the Old Testament has failed Israel because he's not the real God. There's a higher God that they know, that the other Christ has revealed to them, a higher God. But the God of the Old Testament was not the real God, and that's why he seems to have failed Israel. Paul argues through Romans, no, God is faithful. He is calling the Gentiles now, but he will call all the all the Jews later. It's written in contrast to the philosophy of this growing opposition against Paul. It's interesting to note here one other thing about Romans. I said it was connected to Ephesus. In Romans chapter 15, at the end of Romans chapter 15, it kind of concludes and then says amen, like that's the end of the letter. And then in chapter 16, it goes on to address personally about 50 people in Rome, supposedly. I mean, you would think it's in Rome because it's at the end of Romans. However, Paul didn't know anybody at Rome. He'd never been to Rome. He greets 50 people very personally as if they were his converts and his spiritual mother, one of them. One of them is his first fruits of Asia. And one of them, or two of them, are Aquila and Priscilla, whom we know went from Ephesus, went from Corinth to Ephesus. So all these people in Ephesus, he's greeting. How can that be? Well, I think there's another green line coming here from Corinth to Ephesus. That after Paul has composed this masterful piece, which is the book of Romans, he didn't send it just to Rome. He had another copy made. He tacked on greetings to all the people he knew in Ephesus, and he sent it to Ephesus too. That's why it's in our canon. That's why it was in the Anatolian Peninsula when the New Testament was canonized. Why? Why would he send it to Ephesus? Because he's preparing them to fight off the opposition, which he knows will come. In fact, when he leaves Corinth, he sails around the Aegean near Ephesus, and he stops at Miletus, near Ephesus. And in Acts 20, verse 29 through 30, Paul says to the Ephesians, "For I know this, that after my departing shall grievous wolves enter in among you, not sparing the flock. Also of your own selves shall men arise, speaking perverse things, to draw away disciples after them." Why does he think that will happen? Because he's just seen it happen. He's seen it happen in Corinth, he's seen it happen in Galatians, and he knows it's going to come to Ephesus. And he sends a letter to Romans to Ephesus, to prepare their understanding against those ideas. Well, anyway, from Miletus then, at the end of his third journey, he sails back to Caesarea and goes to Jerusalem. And of course, there he's taken in prison. He's imprisoned in Jerusalem and Caesarea for a couple of years. From Caesarea, he appeals to Caesar, and so he sails approximately along this route and ends up in Rome. The year is 59 or 60. He's going to be imprisoned in Rome for about 3 years, 2 or 3 years, and this is the end of the book of Acts. So far, we've only had a handful of books of the New Testament written, and the book of Acts comes to an end now. So we really don't have details about when the others were written. But Paul is stuck in Rome for like 3 years. In Rome, he seems to have commissioned the writing of the Gospels. So I have put on this map, over here in Jerusalem, book number eight, Matthew, 9, Mark, 10, Luke, and 11, Acts. Approximately 61 through 63. He's immobilized in Rome, but he fights the battle by letters. and he documents the life of Jesus Christ, or he has it documented by his close associates, Mark and Luke. How he knows Matthew, I don't know. But it's quite interesting that the Gospels, which we think of as the first things in the New Testament, were written so late, isn't it? Why date them so late? Well, first of all, the Apostle Paul never quotes from the Gospels until about 65. In 1 Timothy, he quotes from it. But before that, never quotes from the Gospels. Why? Because they didn't exist yet in the 50s. Luke is kind of the key here, because Luke writes the Gospel and then follows it with the book of Acts. They're their first and second parts. And the book of Acts ends in about 60 or 61 AD. So Luke and Acts were both written about that same time. Also note that they are written in Greek. There is no Aramaic gospel. There might have been some kind of common source, or it might have all been memorized tradition. Scott Ashley thinks it was all. Those three gospels are similar because they're based upon an oral, a memorized tradition. But Luke does say in the first verse, in fact, of his gospel, that many have attempted to write the account, and he's just another one of them. So there may have been written accounts, though we have no evidence at all of any written gospels before this time. Why did he write the gospels? I think he's countering some wild fables and some wild reinterpretations that are going on in the church about Jesus Christ. The Gospels confirm that Jesus Christ was predicted, just as the Old Testament said, that the Old Testament is faithful. They confirm that Jesus Christ was born as a man, that he lived as a man, which is contrary to the opposition who say he was not a man. They confirm that the Christ is completely faithful to the God of the Old Testament. When they say their Christ reveals a higher God than the God of the Old Testament. But the Gospels confirm that Jesus Christ was completely faithful to the God of the Old Testament. The Gospels confirm that Jesus Christ is the example of what the new man, the converted man, should be. They confirm that Jesus Christ suffered death, which was contrary to the opposition, who did not believe that Christ could die. They believed that Christ was spirit, could not die. In other words, they completely negate that other gospel that Paul is fighting against. Now, from Rome, Paul's still in prison here, flip to some more books written during this time, 61 through 63, I think. Some people think it was a little earlier, but in the ballpark, 61 through 63. Numbers 12 through 15 would be the prison epistles, Philippians. So I've got a line here to Philippi. Number 12, Philippians. Philippians thanks the church at Philippi for supporting him while he's in prison in Rome. But he does make a very stern warning in the book of Philippians. In Philippians 3:2, he says, "Beware of dogs. Beware of evil workers, beware of the concision." Not Jews. Well, at least they're not Jews of Judaism. They're people who preach circumcision, but they're not preaching Judaism. Beware of the concision. Then I've got another line here, fanning out to Ephesus, Laodicea, and Colossae. Why did I do that? Well, Colossians. First of all, Colossians is written at this time. Colossians is answering a plea for help from Epaphras, the elder in Colossae, whose church is being attacked by this opposition. And Paul writes to support him against that opposition. Philemon goes along with the same letter. Philemon lived in Colossae. It has nothing to do with the opposition, but you know the book of Philemon. It comes along with the same delivery. And then Ephesus, or the Ephesians, the book of Ephesians. The interesting thing about Ephesians is that it has no greetings in it. Here we wrote the last chapter of Romans supposedly greets 50 people in a church that he's never been to. And here he writes a letter to Ephesus where he spent 2 years and greets nobody. What's going on there? Well, he greets nobody because he wasn't sending that letter to just Ephesus. It was like a letter you would write at the end of the year and send it to all of your relatives and write in the first line to Uncle Fred and Aunt Millie. The copy that we have of Ephesians was written to Ephesus. So it says, to the church in Ephesus. But another copy of it probably said, to the church in Laodicea. And he sent that copy to Laodicea. And who knows how many other churches in Asia received that same letter, which we call Ephesians. There's a clue in Colossians when Paul says to the Colossians in Colossians 4:16, when this epistle is read among you, cause it to be read also in the church of the Laodiceans, and that you likewise read the epistle from Laodicea. And yet we don't have it, but we do have it, because it was Ephesians. Tychicus was the deliverer. He was the member of Paul's team which delivered those letters. Probably delivered them to several churches. Okay, still in 63 now, at the end of Paul's imprisonment in Rome, we have number 16, Hebrews. Number 16, Hebrews. Now, Hebrews is, in my opinion, obviously written by Paul. I think most of you agree, but not everybody agrees. You ask the scholars, they say, definitely, it's written. One thing we know about Hebrews is it wasn't written by Paul because the wording and the vocabulary, the grammar, is too good. Paul couldn't have written it. But what does Paul write? In Hebrews 13, 23, 24, he says, know you that our brother Timothy is set at liberty, with whom, if he come shortly, I will see you. Now, who else would Paul would come from Italy with Timothy back to the people that he had converted, his churches. Salute all of them that have rule over you, and all the saints, they of Italy salute you. Who else would be writing from Italy with Timothy coming back to his churches but Paul? The people to whom Hebrews was written, the people of Asia Minor, never doubted in history that the letter was from Paul. The only people who ever doubted that it was from Paul were centuries later in Rome. Timothy was still in some kind of custody, it must have been, when Paul wrote this letter. But following Timothy's release, we see in succeeding letters that Paul and Timothy did indeed return to Asia Minor. Hebrews. Why is it written? It's written to counter the opposition in Paul's churches. A lot of people think it's written to the Jews because it talks about the sacrifices and entering the holy place and so on. But if you look at it, it never mentions the temple. The book of Hebrews never mentions the temple. It's only talking about the tabernacle. The issues of the spiritual tabernacle, the mystical meaning of Melchizedek, the intervening function of angels, all that is, those are functions or doctrines of the opposition. And that is what Paul is addressing in the book of Hebrews. These spiritual apostles who preach their allegorical interpretations of Scripture. Okay, but Paul is released from this Roman imprisonment, so we come to the year now 65. In 65, Paul journeys from Rome and drops Titus in Crete. He drops Timothy in Ephesus. And he himself, apparently, from the words in the later epistles, went on to Macedonia. That's the purple line here. And from Macedonia, he writes number 17, 1 Timothy, to Timothy in Ephesus. And he writes number 18, Titus, to Titus in Crete. To Timothy, he writes, 1 Timothy 1, verses 3 and 4, charge some that they teach no other doctrine, neither give heed to fables and endless genealogies. What kind of fables? Well, their doctrines were strange to our ears, but they were based upon fables about this higher God and about the origin of the human's immortal souls. And to Titus, he writes, in Titus 1, chapter 1, verses 10 and 11, to Titus down here in Crete, to him he writes, for there are many unruly and vain talkers and deceivers, especially they of the circumcision. These people are still preaching circumcision, and they continue to preach it for another 200 years, till the end of the 300s. It's ritual circumcision. Okay, from Macedonia, all we know from Paul's words in Titus, but that Paul was in Macedonia. He intended, he said, in Titus 3:12, be diligent to come to me in Nicopolis. He intended to come down here to Nicopolis, for I have determined there to winter. He's going to spend the winter in Nicopolis, but somewhere apparently between Macedonia and Nicopolis, he's caught up in the persecution of Nero and taken to Rome. So that's the detour here. Back to Rome, this time as a prisoner. This is about 67. Might have been a little later, but not much later, because Nero died in 68, so that'd be around then. Okay, from Rome during his second imprisonment there then, we have this green line coming down to Ephesus, and I labeled it, can't barely see that, but it says number 19, 2 Timothy. He writes 2 Timothy from Rome. And he's going to be executed before he gets out of prison here. He writes in 2 Timothy 2:16, shun profane and vain babblings, for they will increase unto more ungodliness. And in 2 Timothy 4:4, and they will turn away their ears from the truth and will be turned unto fables. More calling, this is not the Old Testament. These are syncretistic mixings of Hellenistic fables with the Bible. These are the other gospel. Fables adopted by the Jews in which the creator of the physical things, the creator of the physical creation, is not the true God, but instead they believe that the Christ is a spirit who gives us knowledge of the true God. That was the basic fable. Okay, Paul is executed then in Rome, about 67. And shortly after that, of course, is the catastrophe, the destruction of Jerusalem and the dispersion of the New Testament church in Judea. But there are a few letters in the gap here. After Paul is executed, And before the destruction of Jerusalem, Peter intervenes to encourage the churches of Paul. So I have in this picture lines spreading out from the east. You probably can't see it, it says number 20, 1 Peter, because in 1 Peter 1:1 says, Peter, an apostle of Jesus Christ, to the strangers scattered throughout Pontus, Galatia, Cappadocia, Asia, and Bithynia. All these regions are in Anatolia. They're either Paul's churches or they're descendants of Paul's churches. Paul is writing in Greek, or not Paul, Peter is writing in Greek, or at least he's, maybe it's written by the hand of Silvanus, but Peter is writing a letter from the east. He says in 1 Peter 5:8, be sober, be vigilant, because your adversary, the devil, as a roaring lion, walks about seeking whom he may devour. The danger is not just persecution. There was persecution, of course. It wasn't just persecution, it was false doctrine. Then comes 2 Peter and Jude. So on this map now, somehow Peter has moved all the way from Rome, all the way from Babylon, which is where he wrote 1 Peter, to Rome. And he writes of his impending death there. And by tradition, Peter was killed at Rome. He writes in 2 Peter 1, verse 15, moreover, I will endeavor that you may be able, after my decease, to have these things always in remembrance. Verse 16, for we have not followed cunningly devised fables. He's writing on the same issue to the churches of Paul. In 2 Peter 2:1, he says, but there were false prophets also among the people, even as there shall be false teachers among you, who shall privately bring in damnable heresies. He says in 2 Peter 3:15 through 16, and account that the long suffering of our Lord is salvation, even as our beloved brother Paul, and he writes this because he's writing to the churches of Paul, also according to the wisdom given to him has written to you. He's writing to Paul's churches when he says, as also in all his epistles, speaking in them of these things, in which are some things hard to be understood, which they that are unlearned and unstable wrest, as they do also the other scriptures, unto their own destruction. And indeed, I think, the doctrine of the opposition to Paul sounds very strange to our ears. But if we knew exactly what they were teaching, Paul's difficult scriptures would not be so difficult. The book of Jude is written very similarly. It's almost identical in parts to 2 Peter. And I put a question mark over here because I don't know where it was written from. There's no hint about where it was written, but it must have been written about the same time as 2 Peter and written to the same people. It's written in Greek, of course. Also to Paul's churches. Subject is the same. And somehow, of course, the book of Jude gets into the New Testament canon. How did that happen? Well, it got into the New Testament canon because it was written to these churches. And these churches preserved it in their archives, and then it got into the canon. Now, following Peter's letters, there's a long gap in history. Now, the destruction of Jerusalem in 70, and we don't have any more books of the New Testament written until the late 80s, perhaps, maybe 90. So let's jump to the year 90, and book number 23. Book number 23 is the Gospel of John. This is nearly 30 years after the other three Gospels. the second century writer Irenaeus documents that John did live into the reign of Trajan, which was very near the very end of the century. He was very old. He lived to an old age, nearly to the end of the century. So he wrote the book of John while he had moved. The Jerusalem church had been destroyed, and John had moved then to Paul's churches in Asia, province of Asia. The Gospel of John begins with a classic explanation of something called the Logos, right? The Word. The Word was made flesh. John in that Gospel confirms that the God of the Old Testament is the true God, and that he is, the true God is the creator of the world. And this is denying the very foundation of the heresy that was attacking the church. He confirms that Christ was made flesh, which is also against that heresy, because they believed that their Christ would never be flesh. Book 24, 25, and 26 are the general epistles, 1st, 2nd, and 3rd John. Probably no good way to date those epistles precisely, but they seem to have been written in the late 80s or the 90s, in the throes, and they are very obviously written against the heresy that was troubling the church. Very obvious. Most scholars recognize that the epistles of John are written to combat that heresy. And the presence of Peter and John's letters in the canon of the New Testament also indicate they were indeed written to Paul's churches. Obviously, they're written in Greek. And it's Paul's churches who speak Greek. That's how they got into the church canon, because they were preserved by the Greek churches. And they are very definitely affirming that the opposition are antinomian. They're not Jews. I mean, they might be Jews ethnically, but they're not Jews in doctrine. He writes in 1 John 2:4, you know this one, "He that says, 'I know him,' and keeps not his commandments is a liar, and the truth is not in him." These are the opposition. The basis of the opponent's philosophy was that myth that the creator of the world was not the true God. But the creator of the physical world, they think, imprisons human souls in physical bodies. And their Christ releases your soul from your trap, from your prison of your human body. That's the kind of fable that's being combated here. They would preach Christ, but deny that the man, Jesus of Nazareth, was the Christ. He could not have been a man. And then finally, in about the year 96, just to take a rough guess, nobody knows exactly, the book of Revelation. The book of Revelation is mostly prophecy, of course. Let's say it's written against opposition, but part of it is, isn't it? John writes to the seven churches of Asia. The seven churches of Asia are Paul's churches, either directly or offshoots of the church in Ephesus. And these messages contain some descriptions of the heresy that links it to the heresy that's been combated throughout the New Testament. For example, the Nicolaitans. He battles the Nicolaitans and those who say they are Jews and are not. So that's 27. I guess we're near done. And just a couple of conclusions or generalizations about these 27 books then. First, it's all written in Greek, right? It's all written in Greek. It's because they were all written to Paul's churches. Most of them written in the 50s and 60s, but they were prompted by what was going on in Paul's churches. And two, they were all prompted by that heresy, by those opponents. I think they were the same. They weren't identical, because the heresy morphed into different strains, but it was basically the same heresy. It was strange to us It sounds very strange to us, a combination of discrediting the God of the Old Testament, saying he's not the true God, but at the same time deriving keys to understanding from the Old Testament, from the law. They would take bits and pieces, metaphorically interpreted, ritual out of the law. Circumcision is the prime example. Their orientation was obviously Jewish. That is, they were people of Jewish origin, but the doctrines they came up with were strange to our ears. And I think the opposition to that heresy is the thread that links together the books and letters of the New Testament, and it is why they were written.